Welcome to our discussion today, Protecting and Securing Your Data in a Virtual World, brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. We have four distinguished guests to provide key insights into how they are protecting data in what is quickly becoming a virtual world. But before we get started, there's some important context to the discussion. In 2010, the Office of Management and Budget mandated agencies reduce more than 1,100 data centers currently in use across the government. The goal was twofold: reduce the amount of money spent on data centers, because basically they've grown out of control over the last decade, and secondly, a smaller data center footprint should be easier to secure. That was the first step. Many agencies have made tremendous progress. Take Treasury Department. They started with 40. Now they've reduced by about at least 10% in the last year alone. You'll hear from Raghav Vajula, who's helping lead Treasury's effort, in just a few moments. Data center consolidation is just one change in agency IT infrastructure. Agencies also are under mandates to move to the cloud. But where does data live in that setup? Well, in a virtual world, in many cases. Just recently, OMB introduced two more strategies: shared services in the digital government, and both depend on agencies using virtualization and cloud computing. And then there's several other mandates that agencies are under: move to cloud, move to shared services. Layer on top of those mandates the fact that now security is playing a central role in all of these discussions more than ever. OMB and GSA are leading the FedRAMP effort to have a standardized process for cloud services and security. FedRAMP entered its initial operating capability in early June, but full operating capability is at least a year away. But agencies can't just wait for FedRAMP to secure their systems and data in this ever more virtual world. Today, we will explore real-world examples of how agencies are ensuring data and systems are secure in this virtual world. So today, our guests are Raghav Vajula, Acting Associate CIO for IT Strategy at the Treasury Department; Jerry Reynolds, Manager of IT Operations at USPS; Zach Baldwin, Federal Data Center Consolidation Initiative Program Manager at GSA; and Gigi Shum, Vice President and General Manager of Symantec's Public Sector. So welcome, panel. Well, let's start with some basics. Virtualization, what is it? Let me throw that over to Gigi to start with you.
Thanks, Jason. So virtualization is really become a key enabler in terms of changing the way that IT environments are operating. It changes the way that they acquire resources, the way those resources are managed, and the way that they're utilized. It's also the enabler for agencies that want to move to the cloud, whether that be a public or private cloud.
In many cases, the virtualization is that first step toward the cloud. Very few people actually jump right to the cloud. Let me throw it over to Zach real quick, because as the Federal Data Center Consolidation Initiative, I'm going to get the FDDC and FDCCI, and there's too many acronyms. Can you help with that? Can you give me a sense of what are you seeing as from some of the trends in terms of the data center plans? Is it virtualization first and cloud second?
Yeah, usually that's the path, is that people map their applications, begin virtualization, and then decide whether or not they're going to migrate their apps to a receiving data center or to the cloud, but definitely into a denser IT infrastructure.
And virtualization could mean what? I mean, from Jerry's standpoint, give me a sense. When you guys look at virtualization, are you looking at just taking 10 servers down to one, or what?
So, Jason, thank you very much. So, I have to say, virtualization is not new in IT. We've been doing virtualization for many, many years. The classic, of course, has been the mainframe. We had the ZVM operating system on the mainframe. We continue to operate that. We ran a Sun Solaris world, for example, with virtual zones for many years, with the whole virtualization that was in that platform. Of course, the latest generation of it is with a hypervisor, which is a layer of abstraction, if you would, where we abstract the operating system from the underlying hardware. And that actually is a big enabler for us to be able to do a lot more than what we've done with previous generations of virtualization. But it's not new to us. We've been doing it for a long time. And frankly, I think we know most of the questions, and we're pretty sophisticated at managing it these days.
So then do you guys skip at USPS virtualization and they're going to the cloud because you've been doing it for a while?
No, actually, we've taken progressive steps. As I said, we went through the mainframe, we went through the Sun. Now we're virtualizing on the x86 platform. And for us, to your point about server virtualization, I think we're currently at about an 8-to-1 ratio, and we're driving to almost a 40-to-1 ratio with some of the new bigger hardware that's coming up.
So let me jump over to Raghav. Treasury is maybe in a different spot. Have you guys been virtualized or have been virtualizing for a while, or is this something on the newer side?
No, we've been virtualizing for a while. Probably not, I think Jared can probably point about a decade's worth of history over at USPS, probably in the order of like 5 years' worth of history at Treasury. But I think it's important to point out that there's there's so many things that can be virtualized now. And you know, if you really just make the case of what were the things that used to be physical and are now either software or virtualized, it's a whole host of things, especially the security stack. You know, talking about firewalls, user access gateways, threat managing gateways. There's so many things now that from a security perspective are virtualized. You know, if you ask the question, are security requirements changing? No, they're not. Security requirements are always evolving to address the threats. But I think what is changing is that toolbox, that suite of tools available to the IT community and how they can address those security requirements. And the biggest challenge, I think, when we look at those new tools that are out there is making sure that we're still addressing the requirements and showing how the new tools address those requirements, so we're continuing to address all of our security threats and continue to move forward and meet all the new threats that are evolving out there.
Let me pull it over to Gigi real quick. Now, one of the things that Raghav mentioned was security stack. When you virtualize a security stack, is that the idea of, you're not talking routers and switchers, you're really talking software, is that correct?
Yeah, so if I could just back up a bit, right? What we see is that most of our customers, they start virtualizing their environments because of cost efficiencies. They wanna save money. And they also want to have an environment that's more agile and flexible to be able to stand up new systems quicker, stand up new applications quicker, right? But if you talk to Gartner or Forrester, one of those groups that looks at trends, what they will tell you is that anywhere from 40 to maybe 50% of applications are typically virtualized. And the ones that, those are kind of the low-hanging fruit. The ones that most organizations, and I'd be interested to hear from some of the other panel members, are the truly mission-critical applications that contain very sensitive data or are just very central to the mission of the agency. And when you dig into that a bit and you say, okay, what's stopping you? Typically, it is concerns about protecting that data and protecting the application, whether protecting kind of in the broad sense of the word, right? So being able to ensure high availability, to be able to recover quickly if something should happen, to be able to do efficient backups and recover data, and then all of the kind of traditional security concerns about being able to secure the information in a virtualized environment and maybe a virtualized environment that doesn't sit within your four walls but does exist in the cloud, or in an environment where there are different mixed workloads with different trust zones, if you will, right? And so I'd love to hear from some of my fellow panel members to see whether they've run into these issues and how they're dealing with them.
Well, I think the one thing you said that was key here is the trust zones.
Yep.
And where does the data sit? So let me shift to Jerry, since you have maybe the longer legs in this one on virtualization. Do you have mission-critical data, mission-critical apps that are virtualized, and where do they sit? Do they sit in a data center run by USPS or by another government agency, or do they sit in a managed service run by your data center operator in the private sector?
So we've used almost every one of those solutions that you've mentioned. But by and large, the Postal Service hosts all of its critical mission-critical applications within its own data center. Singular data center with a backup data center is our model. We're a two data center environment. In terms of virtualization, it's amazing though, because what we found is we virtualize the web and the app tiers and we put them in secured zones. And of course, firewall protected them and made our kind of security around that. The database tier itself, though, we by and large have not virtualized. Because we use a clustered technology within the database tier, and we were really hesitant about the timing and the latency issues around the interconnects on the virtual the clusters. And so what we've done is we used a consolidation approach rather than a virtualization approach there. So we may have 40 applications sharing the same database servers or cluster of database servers and not virtualized. And that's worked really well for us.
Let me break it down for a second, because one of the things you mentioned was the database tier. And I think that's the key applications. You hear agencies all the time say, we have too many applications. We've got to reduce the number of applications. But you're actually talking about how, when you talk about a cluster of applications, it could be, are you talking about application reduction, in terms of getting rid of duplication, or are you talking about the way you manage them?
More the latter, the way we manage it. It's really, we consolidate the applications onto the database cluster. So a 3-node or a 4-node or maybe even an 8-node database cluster for a high availability. that's not virtualized. But then we do virtualize, again, the web and the app tiers. And we've been very successful at that. We've had to work with a lot of the vendors who told us it couldn't be done. But by and large, we've been very successful at virtualizing those layers, but not the database.
Yeah, and I think another overall reason for this consolidation is to increase your security posture. As Jason said, when we opened up, we started out with 1,100 data centers across the government. Right now, we're at 3,133 in the federal inventory. So reducing the amount of redundancy in the data centers makes it a lot easier. You know, if you're running 10-to-1 or 8-to-1 on a server in virtualization, it's a lot easier to manage and have a unified security posture with these applications all in the same place. And we also see, as you virtualize these applications and bring them into what I call the receiving data centers, you do have you find some deduplication. I always say whenever I move apartments, I always throw away as much as I can so I don't have to carry it. So you do see some deduplication across there and these gained efficiencies. And one of the major ones is to come up with a unified security posture for your applications as a whole.
And does security get a little easier because it's spread out among not more data centers, but the way virtualization works, does it make security a little bit easier? I'm just kind of throwing out there to the group.
Yeah, I think in terms of virtualization, does it make it easier? It definitely makes it easier in the sense that it allows to have a much more sense of uniformity across the whole bandwidth of infrastructure you may have in place. Instead of having to go from machine by machine to see what maybe the unique configuration of those machines, the virtualization is much easier to kind of enforce standards across your entire infrastructure. I think the piece is in terms of, you know, what security practices really best position you to be successful. It's the same practice that we always talk about in IT, just simple things like how do we manage identities across our entire environment. You know, one of the challenges that I think every agency is going through is as we try and consolidate things, the key driver to making things appear palatable to our end users, you know, whether it's our workforce or our customers, is sometimes as simple as how many times I have to log in over and over again. So if we can make that process more seamless for them, and a lot of that is through consistent identity management, and virtualization can really take advantage of that, because then you have a situation where all your different application systems out there can in fact have the appearance of acting in a much more coherent manner simply by the fact that you're allowing your users not to have to see them as different applications. It's a much more seamless experience. So that basic practice in conjunction with virtualization really leads to a lot of positive end user experience.
Jerry,
I wanted to comment on both something that Zach said and Gigi had both said, and then I want to come back and talk about the security thing for real quickly. So Zach mentioned about the opportunities to consolidate with virtualization. I would also say that the virtualization is also an enabler for agility. So as workload demands increase because of the virtual resources, we're able to scale up an application and scale it back down. I know the Postal Service obviously moves a lot of mail during the holiday season, right? Mm-hmm. That's our peak period. And so our ability to scale up during that holiday period and scale it back down without wasting resources the rest of the year for those particular applications is really beneficial to us. With regard to the security question, the complexity of security, there's an interesting concept that's taking place in the marketplace today about virtual data centers, not just virtual applications. And I would say that the level of virtualization when you get to virtual data centers begins to actually make security much more complicated. Because as servers begin to share IP addresses or names, common names and common IP addresses, they become entities in which it's even harder to track. So the whole idea of NATing virtual data centers, and I think that's where we're going to be going as we begin to move whole applications into the cloud and make the application itself portable, is going to make it very difficult. In the old days, we used to be able to tie you down to a physical server. Our auditors would go in and they would say, I want to see the device. And you walk them up to the cabinet and you would unlock the door and they would touch it and they would go, that's where my data is, right? In the new world, in the virtual world, they can't do that. But in the virtual data center world, we can't even tell them the name or the IP address of the server. So it's going to make things much more difficult.
Let me go over to Gigi.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. So, Jerry, I think you're exactly right. And one of the things that Symantec, we've been working with our customers for the last few years, is around the shift of what we call a system-centric approach to an information-centric approach. And it's designed to deal with exactly that issue that you brought up, right? So if you think about security in the past, it was about protecting a physical infrastructure, whether that be a perimeter, whether that be systems themselves, whether that be your network. And in this new, highly virtualized, cloud-first world, really it's more about protecting the information. And before you can protect it, you have to understand where the information is and you know, what information exists where, who should have access to that information, who shouldn't, and then have the appropriate protections in place that really are tagged to that information. And we believe at Symantec that approach will become a key enabler in helping organizations virtualize more.
But one thought that comes from this, and we can kind of take this into the break and then maybe come back out and pick it back up, is the idea of if your data is separated on different data areas or in your virtual environment, doesn't it become much safer than if you were, as Gigi once described, you had one data center or one server per data, per application, per data set, and then if that one got hacked into, then therefore your resiliency and all those things become more problematic. Real quick, Jerry, and then lead us off, and we're going to go into break.
Okay. So clearly multiple copies of data is a good thing, right? That's why we take backups. That's why we take snapshots in our storage frames to be able to kind of keep record and be able to roll back if an event ever happens. I think it's also important to talk about protection. Protection isn't just about protecting against data leakage or inappropriate exposure of information to people who shouldn't be seeing the information. It's also about denial of service. So you've got to make sure your security handles all of the major threats, not just the one or two. And I think in the future, I think Gigi's right, we're going to see more data protection than we are server protection.
All right, that's a good place to leave off. We're going to come back from break and pick that right back up. You're listening to Protecting and Securing Your Data in a Virtual World, brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The right virtualization strategy can take you from static infrastructure silos to an automated high-density cloud that transforms IT service delivery. And the path goes straight through business-critical virtualization. Symantec has the backup, recovery, and security solutions you need to protect your virtualized environment with confidence. For the top 10 tips on protecting a virtualized environment, visit www.virtualbackupplan.com. Symantec, confidence in a connected world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Protecting and Securing Your Data in the Virtual World, brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Our guests today are Raghav Vajula, the Acting Associate CIO for IT Strategy at the Treasury Department, Jerry Reynolds, Manager of IT Operations at the Postal Service, Zach Baldwin, the Federal Data Center Consolidation Initiative Program Manager at GSA, and Gigi Shum, the Vice President and General Manager of Symantec's Public Sector. So before break, we had Jerry finish us off talking security, of course, because we're all about security today, but specifically the different threats that all need to be handled, backup, protection in the virtual world. So let me start with Raghav. Give me a sense, how, when you guys look at all the different threats, how do you kind of balance those needs? Because they're never going to end, obviously.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think before the break, we talked about securing data and understanding, you know, what we're trying to do at Treasury is understand not just securing data, but understanding who is accessing the data and when. So we look at HSPD 12 and all the longstanding programs that have been out there. The big idea that we've all been trying to achieve in government is having a single digital identity for each person in the federal government. So when you have all these systems with their own password protection schemes, what you're really doing is making the threat much more difficult to manage, because each system will have its own set of identities that we have to track down. A big key for us is in assessing security is, hey, let's get a path on getting everyone in compliance with HSPD 12, a single digital identity for everyone working through our system. And in that way, we really have a sense of who is actually on our network very specifically, and really reducing the threat when it comes to that from that perspective of the whole security stack. Then once we handle that, then we have a much greater sense of whenever someone is accessing our information, we have a really good idea of, hey, is it someone who's authorized to access it or not? So all these things kind of work in conjunction. It's just that basic practice of who is your key user, what are they doing, and how are they accessing your data? And now we have to learn how to do that regardless of where the data is, whether it's in the cloud environment, whether it's in a data center that, you know, we're operating, whether it's in a data center that another organization is operating, tracking how our digital identities are going across our network and accessing that data. That's a big part of how we're trying to prepare for future security threats.
Well, let me just throw one out there, because Isn't it easier in the virtual world to deal with that roles and responsibilities issue because you can kind of cordon off a specific set of data that this will only be used by people who meet X level? Or is it harder because your data is not just on this one server that's sitting in your data center in your basement?
I think it definitely makes it easier. It definitely makes it easier because I think the biggest challenge is that by getting a handle on how individual identities are managed throughout your system, that gives you the flexibility to really think about how to best deploy data, whether it's virtual or whether it's in one data center versus another data center, to really make sure the data is operating to the best benefit of the workforce and to the best benefit of the taxpayers.
Because a lot of what I'm hearing is all about the roles and responsibilities. That's the next great cyber area. So let me throw, I guess, to Gigi, since you're our, if you will, cyber expert on the panel. Are you seeing more customers coming to you and saying, well, we want to incorporate HSPD-12 or CAT cards or some kind of roles and responsibilities feature into their security as they're looking at whether it's virtualized or not?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that you've kind of heard threads of throughout this whole conversation is what's really key is to have really good security policies, right, to start there and understand the roles and responsibilities. If you didn't have that in your data center and your environment before you virtualized, you're going to be in trouble once you virtualize, right? So you have to have some good practices to start with. Some of the things get easier, as Raghav was talking about, and then there are other challenges. As an example, you now have the ability in a highly virtualized environment to stand up new VMs very, very quickly. And so you better make sure that you have a set of security policies and that you've pre-thought that out so that as you stand up these things, you're standing them up with the appropriate security. And a very strong identity management program is absolutely a part of that, right? The understanding of what data is going to exist in that VM and who should or should not have access to it.
You said two things. I want to go to Zach real quick, and then I'm going to come back to you, Jerry, because I think, again, with your experience with the virtualization. Zach, when you look at those data center consolidation plans, how much is security playing a role? How much was security supposed to play a role?
Well, when we kicked off about 18 months ago, we had four main goals of the data center consolidation initiative. Promote the use of green IT and gain efficiencies, reduce data center costs of hardware, and, the third one was improve the overall IT security posture of the government. I mentioned before in our conversation, GSA went to email in the cloud about a year ago using Google. That's a mission-critical application, and, not only have they been able to save about $15 million in it, but they've reduced an email infrastructure that had 17 physical locations. So it's hard to put consistent security controls on something that's found in 15 different places. So even though the cloud has its own issues with security and that have to be addressed, moving everything to a single area and being able to manage a single instance in the cloud of email makes unified security a lot easier.
But when you look at those data center consolidation plans, are agencies, from what you're seeing, how much attention are they giving to security in the consolidation plans? Can you give us a sense?
I think it is a pretty major driver as they bring these redundant facilities into their receiving data centers. They're able to, like I said, put these better security controls into place and manage it under common platforms. Agencies seem to be coming around a couple enterprise type platforms. It's a lot easier to manage security around there too. So it is a major driver in this, and consolidation, I think, is a way to increase your security posture.
Let me shift over to Jerry. At the Postal Service, since you guys have been doing the virtualization for a long time, how have you been kind of taking Gigi's advice in the sense of using, having security policies in place first before the virtualization happens or as it happens?
So as you know, the Postal Service is the most trusted government agency, right? We wish everybody were trusted as much as we are. And we take that very, very seriously in the IT world. And so we've had a robust set of security policies. I did want to comment, though, that Gigi really raises an interesting dimension around the security, and that is your underlying infrastructure needs to be integrated with your identity management. So when you bring in new products, if they're not able to connect to your Active Directory or your LDAP infrastructure, you're not able to connect them to your security monitoring tools, et cetera, We've struggled with that in several different technology projects that we've had. I also wanted to really give kudos to Zach and the GSA for outsourcing the email into the cloud. But I wanted to ask Zach, if you don't mind, how did you handle the security dimensions around that for e-discovery products? And I think there's other data leakage protection, those kinds of things.
I'd have to defer to the CIO office who actually
implemented
that. But, you know, all these, you know, like you said, it's all interesting stuff that has to be addressed when you go to the cloud and you don't have that physical server that you can point to and say, that's where my data is and that's how I can track it down.
So some of the CIOs that I've spoken with, what they're doing is they're retaining that dimension for as they outsource email. So they keep their e-discovery and they keep their data leakage protection, but they get Google actually host the email, which is a very interesting hybrid solution to maintaining that security posture.
Gigi?
Yeah, Jerry, we are definitely seeing that. You know, one of the things about moving to the cloud is figuring out what makes sense to move to the cloud and what really you should keep in-house. And we've seen several instances of where customers are looking to move their email to the cloud but do want to keep the e-discovery on-premises so that they can be sure that they can do the data retention searches when they need to, either it's a FOIA request or they're involved in some sort of a lawsuit. So we are absolutely seeing a trend in that direction.
I think e-discovery is one of those areas of cloud that's not quite as mature as some of the other things. And I think a lot of, if you look at the Justice Department, there's a gentleman there, Jason Barron, who does some great speaking about this issue. And there's some other people at Justice who are really working on it. But I think you're right. That is one of the big areas of concern among CIOs, at least from what you're hearing, from what I'm hearing from.
Yeah,
here's a CIO here, Raghav. How are you guys dealing with it?
She's about email in the cloud. I think it points to, you know, sometimes people get caught up in, you know, how does the federal government do things differently from what the private sector does? And I think email is an instance of where the federal government, what they think about, what we think about in terms of how to manage email. For us, we've talked about, you know, records management, e-discovery, all these sort of things. Email for the federal government is the record of our work. And because, you know, we're supposed to be able to always show transparency to the public, the way we think about email is not necessarily the same way a private sector company thinks about email. You know, a lot of private sector companies that will have policies in place where they will have to, where they will be looking at ways to either delete or archive or somehow eliminate a lot of their email records. Simply that's a part of their policy and part of how they manage costs. In the federal government, we have the exact opposite. We have a lot of policies in place where email must last forever. We have to find a way to access it and regardless of how many years later on the FOIA request or the request from the legislative branch may come in. So the way when people talk about email in the cloud, for the federal government, we have to break that down into our definition of email is archiving, it's a network management, and it is then the email service. And so we have a very much more complicated infrastructure we have to think about in terms of just putting email out on the cloud. So I would have to applaud GSA and how they, you know, had to work through all that, because I'm sure they had to think through all these different options about how do we do our archiving, how do we actually manage the email service, and then how do we manage that network efficiency so we abide by all the things like trusted internet connections and all these other policies that are in place for security management.
I think a lot of agencies are going down that path. I mean, if you look at USDA, Interior, there's several others who are saying, okay, how do we deal with email in the cloud and the e-discovery and the archiving has to be written out in the SLAs, which actually is a great segue, so thank you, Raghav, to the idea of, as you're managing your data, as you're managing your applications in the virtual world, in even cloud, is there a difference? I mean, or how big of a difference, I guess, is it from a security standpoint when you're talking about data centers that are public sector data centers, meaning owned by USPS or Treasury or GSA, versus data centers that are owned by somebody else, but maybe, you know, under a managed service deal? Is that where the service level agreements come in and other types of contracting pieces? Let me throw it out to the with Gigi.
Sure, thanks. I think there's absolutely a part of it that is where you rely on service level agreements and things like that. But I think there's also a technology piece to it as well. If you think about it, I'll use an example, a personal example from inside Symantec, right? We have several different cloud-based applications that we use. Our customer relationship management system is a cloud-based system. Our expense reporting system is a cloud-based system. And most recently, we have just moved our HR systems to a series of a couple different cloud-based systems. And so now any single user at Symantec may need to access 4, 5, 6 different cloud-based applications in their daily business. And some of which have mission-critical, PII kind of information that's highly sensitive. And so what we really want to think about is, I think in addition to SLAs and policies and all the sort of known good practices, you also want some technology that allows you as an organization to retain some control and enforce those policies. If, as an example, certain data must be encrypted, then you want to make sure that you've got a layer that forces that encryption. If you've got data that you need multi-factor authentication, right, because it's more critical, and so you want, you know, two-factor authentication to access it, you want to be able to enforce that. So this concept of having a layer which integrates in with your LDAP architecture so that you're not having to, you know, duplicate and redouble efforts, but allows you to retain that control and is independent of any particular cloud provider, we think is a really important concept.
And where does that technology sit? Does it sit in the cloud provider? Does it sit on your end, Raghav?
So I think one thing that Gigi brings up is pretty interesting there is what you're seeing in a lot of the security policy approaches. I think in the past, a lot of the agencies, because of the physical element of a lot of the equipment that we'd buy, the auditor would come out and it says, hey, yes, this physical server is here and it's separated off from this other environment. In the virtualized environments, the way the policy community has evolved is we're much more focused on continuous monitoring. And we'll monitor everything, all the traffic, wherever it's coming from, who's doing what. Continuous monitoring is a much bigger component of security enforcement throughout the federal government. So I think the question is, well, how do we manage continuous monitoring? Where does all that equipment rest? And I think it's fair to say that is a question that a lot of agencies are going through right now. I think in terms of comfort, it's going to stay inside the federal government simply because there's a lot of issues going on with HSPD-12 and all those sort of things where the control really has to be for the federal government to make sure that all these other organizations out there are, in fact, operating in a secure manner. So continuous monitoring really is something that on the federal side we have to take ownership for.
Jerry, let me ask you, when you guys are looking at your security from a standpoint, how are you kind of looking at your data?
So let me just, from my perspective, how it works. Well, I know we put a lot of like sniffer type technology that watches transactions that they leave our network and into other cloud network providers, you know, monitoring packets, right? But, there's an interesting thing. In the old days, I'm going to say the old days, we did a lot of tape backups, right? And we'd send those tape backups to an offsite. And what we would do is we would actually go visit that site once a year or twice a year and make sure they were treating our data well. You know, it was locked up and nobody else had access to it. It was fire protected. Armed security guards were transporting it or whatever, right? Well, in today's world, in the cloud provider model, we want to do the same thing, but a lot of the T's and C's just aren't there yet in these cloud providers to be able to really do that level of auditing to make sure that that these cloud service providers are not co-hosting our data with somebody else's data or commingling it, right? We don't have the ability to do that check and balance like we had with our tape librarian or tape offsite storage in years past. So that's one of the reasons that a lot of the stuff for us still stays on-premise, all the critical stuff, because we haven't seen the T's and C's and those models work out from a legal contractual perspective. The internal cloud model really does allow our auditors to make sure that all those critical policies are enforced, you know, data segregation, developers not having access to production stuff, those kinds of things, you know, encryption of PII and other sensitive data, for example. So that's one of the reasons we tend to have most of the things still on-premise for us.
And real quick, Gigi?
Yeah, I was just going to maybe put a plug in for my colleague here, Zach. And programs like the GSA's program FedRAMP, I think, is a really important step in helping to ensure that when you're talking about a continuous monitoring program, you're not just talking about those assets that are living within your four walls, but you are looking to cloud-based environments and making sure that the cloud providers are held to the same standard that you would hold yourself to.
All right, great place to take a quick break. You're listening to Protecting and Sharing Your Data in a Virtual World, brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The right virtualization strategy can take you from static infrastructure silos to an automated high-density cloud that transforms IT service delivery. And the path goes straight through business-critical virtualization. Symantec has the backup, recovery, and security solutions you need to protect your virtualized environment with confidence. For the top 10 tips on protecting a virtualized environment, visit www.virtualbackupplan.com. Symantec, confidence in a connected world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Protecting and Securing Your Data in a Virtual World, brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Our special guest today are Raghav Vajula, the acting CIO for IT strategy at the Treasury Department, Jerry Reynolds, manager of IT operations at the Postal Service, and Zach Baldwin, Federal Data Center Consolidation Initiative Program Manager at GSA, and Gigi Shum, the Vice President and General Manager at Symantec's public sector. Now, before break, we got a little bit into the FedRAMP idea, the idea of standardizing cloud security. So let me throw it over to Zach just a little bit and give us a sense. FedRAMP is into their initial operating capability. What's that mean, and what's that mean for both Gigi at Symantec and Raghav and Jerry at the agencies?
Well, I think our launch is actually tomorrow on the 6th. But, you know, when I joined the cloud computing PMO at GSA, we tried to promote other agencies to use cloud computing. One of the key parts of that is multi-tenancy in an environment. So what we realized is that every agency could not put their own security controls, their own CNA process, and have that work efficiently. So we created the FedRAMP process, Federal Risk Assessment Management Program. So we'd have a consistent set of controls that we could run against an environment one time and have other agencies reuse that and gain those efficiencies. So by doing that, we think we secure a better security posture for these shared environments, which I personally believe the multi-tenancy is one of the key factors of cloud computing.
So let me throw over to Gigi, because you guys are going to be eventually FedRAMPed to introduce the new verb into the lexicon of our language. When you look at the security controls that they laid out, I think it's 168 for low and another 178 or something for moderate or 200 for moderate. When you look at that, what does it mean from your perspective as a vendor who's trying to meet those goals?
Sure, absolutely. Well, there's no question that it will involve some work on our part. So I will put that out there. But frankly, it's a roadmap for us. And so it does make our life easier. If we didn't have something like FedRAMP, then what Jerry expected for USPS might be different than what Raghav expected for Treasury. And we'd be trying to, you know, customize to meet everybody's needs. So this really does give us the roadmap for what we need to do that will ensure that we meet, as a cloud provider, that we meet the needs of the entire federal government. And the other piece, and Zach did not pay me to say this, but both GSA and NIST, frankly, worked really closely with the vendor community to try to get a real-world sense of what the cloud providers could and should do to help ensure better security. And so I applaud them for being so proactive in their outreach.
Do you have a sense of the FedRAMP standards, how they compare to what you guys had to do to be FISMA certified? Because you guys had gone through that experience many times. I mean, probably too many times.
Yeah. There's a lot of similarities. There really are. And so it's almost like that FedRAMP grew from the base of FISMA, right? Using kind of that as the base and then thinking about, okay, FISMA was designed before there was the world of cloud. And so how do we take those best practices, security controls, and now translate them into a cloud-based environment? So absolutely, they're very closely linked.
Well, let me shift to Jerry real quick. Since you guys have been doing virtualization and in some ways the managed service idea of cloud for a long time, when you did security, when you say, okay, we want to have this data layer secured or this application secured, you relied on FISMA, but did you have to go above and beyond because it was different? Or was what they're doing with FedRAMP and what they're doing with building off FISMA kind of what you guys did, but internally?
So the Postal Service is a little bit of a unique animal in that it is an independent federal agency, right? So we have our own internal set of standards that we have to live up to. I think we refer to it as the AS805 set of standards, which govern all of our security controls. And so if it would, it's FISMA, but it's FISMA Plus, right? And a lot of our security was built around the old school about physical security and then eventually network security. And then we layered onto it data encryption. But all of those, if you think about it, had nothing to do with virtualization. They really come back to the data and access to the data is where most of our security postures are today and continue to focus.
It almost goes back to what we talked about earlier in the conversation with Raghav about identity management and roles and responsibilities. Let me shift to another thing that came up earlier in the conversation is the idea of we talked a lot about the technology. We talked a lot about the process by which to secure the applications and the data. But there's another piece to this, which is kind of the, if you will, the softer side, the budget side, the human resources side. And maybe let me start with Raghav about the budget. Does virtualization change the way you guys budget, pay for it?
Yeah, it's probably the one area where it's made the biggest impact, and I would think about how we operate, is on the budgeting side of all the IT management functions. You know, the way we talk about it is in terms of virtualization and consolidation, it's a time-consuming activity. It's tedious. It can be very tactical, move from point A to point B. But it's all very doable. It's a matter of laying it out, putting a schedule on, and just executing on it. Figuring out how things are actually allocated for cost-wise, you know, what are the costing methodologies, the budgeting methodologies, it's very different in a virtualized world. You haven't, you know, in the previous way, people kind of, you know, bought their physical equipment, they bought their software licenses. You kind of could very easily tie apples to apples in terms of equipment and budgets. In a virtualized world, you know, you're never actually buying a physical piece of equipment. You're never actually getting your own little software CD. So how we cost out our support in those environments, it can be very challenging because I think we pointed out earlier as demands change in terms of how much people actually need virtualized environments, that changes the cost methodology. So you're used to a whole world where people have great stability in their budgeting and controls, and now you're going into a world where it's highly dynamic. And how do we explain that to our budgeting community? How do we explain that to our business community?
And that was my next question. How do you explain that to the business community? Since, Gigi, you're a representative here from the business community.
Sure.
Does this change the way you bill, Raghav, or another client?
Yeah, actually it does, right? One of the things that we've seen over the last couple of years is that our customers, right, whether they be federal government or state and local government customers, are asking us to be flexible and come up with usage-based contractual structures and billing structures. You know, if you're standing up an environment that's going to be shared among a bunch of different people, you need to figure out what piece of that pie is being used by what person, but then you also only want to pay for the part that is being used. And so there's technology that can help figuring out who's using what piece of the pie, but the other piece of it, Jason, that you're exactly right, is then the vendor community has to be flexible enough to say, we'll change our contractual structures, instead of saying, okay, you've now bought an enterprise license for this perpetual software. Instead, it is usage-based. So your bill this month may be different than your bill next month. It may go up, it may go down, depending on your usage.
And Congress, I don't think, really appreciates that when you have different, your bills change and it goes up and down. Now, let me shift to Jerry since you do answer to Congress and we won't go in that direction. But how have you dealt with that contracting piece or the vendor piece when it comes to virtualization?
So we continue. This is an area where actually we have a lot of struggle because, as Raghav said, at the end of the day, we have a legacy of procuring things on a kind of a capital-based purchase. People would buy things and they would sweat that asset and be part of a program that was planned for 5 years or more, right? In today's world, it's almost a monthly charge. And getting that transition to occur from a CapEx to an OpEx-based model has been very, very much a challenge within the Postal Service. And it's actually part of the discussions that are ongoing as I make the trips here to headquarters and talk to the budgeting people because, frankly, they're struggling with it. They even struggle with something as simple as the definition of what is a server in the virtual world. In the old days, it was a physical asset that could be depreciated. Now, what is it? And is it an IP address? Is it a kernel? And people they can't get their arms around it even, okay?
We may need some help from the CFO folks on that depreciation question because I think that's out of our realm. The other piece to this is the human resources piece, the IT folks, if you will. how do their skills need to change? Jerry, you guys have been doing this a long time. Let me throw it to you.
So I had an old boss one time that told me, he said, you know, Jerry, you could leave IT and come back, and within 6 months you'd be up with everybody else because the world's changing that fast. And in reality, it is changing pretty quickly, and keeping people's skills current is one of the biggest challenges we have within the Postal Service. We actually put a lot of energy and effort into keeping people up to date with their conferences or training, things like that. We also do kind of cross-training from our vendors. We bring in experts and let them work side-by-side, shoulder-to-shoulder with our staff on board so that they begin to pick up those skills. And at the end of the day, though, they have to pick them up and they have to run with them. And, you know, it's typical, if you would, management 101. How do you keep all of your people current with the ongoing technology challenges?
Gigi, do you want to pick up?
No, other than I think that Jerry makes a good point in that as this world continues to evolve quickly in terms of the IT skills that are needed, it is important that you keep your people trained. I think the Postal Service has done a great job with their reach out efforts to the private sector community, to the vendor community, to share information and leverage best practices.
All right, well, we are getting toward the end of the show. Before we go there, we're going to enter the lightning round. So I'd like to throw out, 10 questions. No. Very quickly, have you guys keep going. But let me actually start with some best practices, some lessons learned, because I think when you have a conversation about new technology, about changes to the way you're supposed to work, that leaves a lot of questions and probably more questions than maybe answers. So I'm gonna start with Zach, I think, on this one. Zach, just from your experience of reading everyone's data center consolidation plan and memorizing it and putting yourself to bed each night, tears dripping on the plans because they're so great. Give me a sense, what are some of the trends maybe you're seeing that you see a lot of, over and over again people doing that maybe could be considered a burgeoning best practice?
I think in the agencies, we have agencies all over the place. Some have really gone down the line, are virtualized and are in a few data centers. Some are just starting their efforts. One of the things we're seeing is it's a cultural change. You have to get everyone in your agency or in your company on board. We have this old culture of I get an application, I buy a server, one app, one server, the lights are blinking, it's running at 10%, that's fine. That culture has to change. People aren't going to be able to reach out and physically touch their servers anymore. They have to be comfortable with being in a virtualized environment and being in a consolidated infrastructure. So I think that's the main thing, is you'd have to have an overall agency plan. You have to have your whole agency on board, no matter how many bureaus you have out there, and get everyone involved with the change.
Maybe some buttons that say, don't hug your server today. It's okay.
Exactly.
Raga, let me go to you. When you're from your experience, you guys have done some consolidation at Treasury. What are you seeing as maybe some advice and best practices?
I think the biggest thing that we've run into the last couple of years is just how much data there is out there, and just getting better at using data to inform our decisions. When we look at making more and more virtualized servers, more and more information out there available to us and accessible to us, I want to applaud the federal DCCR program, because they really went to a data-based way of tracking everything. There's always a little disagreements on, what the definition of these data set are, but it's much more data driven now. We're making decisions based on, what is going to result in the best outcome for the agency and for the taxpayers. What is that right number of data centers to have? What is that right number of, virtualized levels to have? And make it based on data, make it based on real money outcomes. That's been a huge bonus for us in going through this process, because really forced our entire organization, both on the IT side and the budget side, to become much more familiar with the metrics behind our core operating measures.
All right, Jerry, since you guys have had the long run on this, what are some of the things you've learned?
So let me just piggyback a little bit off of what Raja said. Postal Service, because we receive no tax subsidies, we are fundamentally funded by the sale of stamps, by and large, right? And so to us, the business decisions and the ROI has been the driver. And that's why we're so far ahead of the curve, because we're trying to make good economic sense. I also want to applaud Zach, because he hit the nail on the head. The transition from the legacy world to the virtual world is all about a cultural expectation. It's a paradigm shift. And in order to be really successful with that, you need some champions. You need some people that catch the vision, that are willing to fight the battles, that are willing to overcome the obstacles that are necessary to get there. And I think that's been our key to our success. We've had those right champions.
And Gigi will give you the final word.
Sure. So I would say the key word is plan, right? Plan for it. Think about it. If you had bad habits or bad practices in your physical data center operation, those will just become magnified in your virtual operation. So focus on the information, protecting that information. And I say protecting in a very broad way, resiliency, availability, security. And it's about the people and the information. Raghav talked a lot about identities, identity management, protecting those identities, protecting your critical information.
Very good. That's a great way to end it. And I think we got some good advice from everyone. This has been a fun and a very informative conversation. Thank you for listening to Protecting and Securing Your Data in a Virtual World, brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. To hear the show in its entirety or for more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword virtual.
As part of Sheehy Auto Store's annual campaign to support breast cancer awareness, the GW Mammovan will be on site at the Sheehy Ford and Nissan in Springfield on Thursday, June 28th from 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Sheehy, in conjunction with the George Washington University Medical Faculty Associates, will offer free mammograms for those who don't have accepted health insurance coverage. Appointments are required. Call today to reserve your spot, 202-741-3252. That's 202-741-3252.
Share your home, change the world. Host a Youth for Understanding exchange student. Imagine welcoming a young person from Thailand, Japan, Germany, or one of 60 other countries into your family. Now everyday experiences take on a new and exciting twist. American traditions gain deeper meaning as you share them with your new son or daughter. Call 1-866-4-YFU-USA or visit the website at yfu-usa.org to learn how you can become a Youth for Understanding host family.
Celebrate summer at Safeway's Barbecue Battle, June 23rd and 24th on Pennsylvania Avenue. Benefiting the Boys and Girls Clubs, this great family event features free food samples, free kids rides, and activities like NBA Nation, plus 30 bands on three stages. Hear Soul Asylum and a special tribute to the legendary godfather of go-go, Chuck Brown. For more information, call 202-829-3099 or visit bbqdc.com. We'll see you at the BBQ.
I didn't think it was possible for me to be an alcoholic. I was 24 with a good career. I thought I was too smart and that alcoholism only happened to middle-aged men and celebrities. I thought something else was making me sick, shaky, and afraid to face people. Then I found AA and discovered it wasn't something else, it was alcohol. AA helped me find a new life. Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. Look us up. Check your phone book, newspaper, or AA.org.